The Doors, James Brown, The Grateful Dead, David Bowie, the list goes on from 1967 to 1973. Michael Oberman interviewed more than 300 top musical artists. Collected together for the first time, Fast Forward, Play and Rewind presents more than 100 interviews that Oberman conducted with the most important musical artists of the day. The book is called Fast Forward, Play and Rewind. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US, Michael Oberman himself. Michael, good morning. Good morning to you. Good afternoon from us.
Good late morning. I'm almost ready for brunch.
Almost. That's what we like to hear on a Friday. Whereabouts are you? Are you West Coast, East Coast? Whereabouts in the States are you today?
I am in a city called Columbia, Maryland, midway between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, but famous for the Meriwether Post Pavilion, the only venue in the world where Led Zeppelin and The Who were co-billed.
Ooh, now that must have been one to shake the fillings out of your teeth. Tell me a little bit about how you got into the world of, would you describe it as music journalism, rock journalism, of getting away with it until somebody found out what you were up to? How would you describe it?
Well, let me tell you, it was an interesting childhood. In 1956, when I was 9 years old and my brother was going on 13, my father brought home the first Elvis Presley album on RCA Records. My father was a singer, and he introduced us to rock and roll at an early age. And fast forwarding a little bit to my teen years, when I was 16 years old and my brother was 20, my brother was a music columnist for the Washington Star newspaper. He asked if I wanted a part-time job there as a copy boy. Basically, a copy boy is a schlep. He does everything in the newsroom that a reporter wants him to do. And I was envious of my older brother because at age 20, he was writing about music. And then this miracle happened. The Beatles came to the United States, and their first concert in the U.S. was here in Washington, D.C., and my brother took me to that concert. And my brother went backstage and interviewed the Beatles, the first of a series of five interviews he did with them. And I looked at my brother, and I saw him surrounded by beautiful women. And I said, Ron, if you ever leave writing that column, I want that gig. And in 1967, he left to work at Mercury Records in Chicago. When I was still in journalism school at the University of Maryland, and I went to the entertainment editor, her name was Countess Fifi Groska.
I'm sorry, her name was Countess Fifi Groska. Is that really...
Yeah, pretty amazing. She was a Hungarian countess. So I said, Gigi, I want to write the column. And she said, Michael, I need to remind you, you're 19, you're still in journalism school. We have reporters here with master's degrees who would like to write that column. And I said, Gigi, let me remind you that my brother was 20 and still in journalism school when he started writing a column. And Phoebe said, Michael, you're right. Write three, and we'll see how it goes. And that three turned into 300. And it was six dizzying years of backstage interviews, interviews on the phone, interviews in other cities, being in a hotel suite with Janis Joplin between shows, doing an interview with her. And on the coffee table between us is a bottle of Southern Comfort and a water pipe called a bong. And Janis said to me, Michael, would you like a Coke or would you like a shot? And I said, no, I'm here for the interview. And Janis leaned over. She had a Mexican peasant blouse on. And one breast came out of the blouse. And it stayed out for the entire 20-minute interview. And I'm trying to look Janis Joplin in the eyes and all I'm seeing is a breast.
Yes, I know.
And, I mean, I was 20 years old. This was incredible.
Indeed, indeed. I just want to, it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because you mentioned your brother interviewing the Beatles in 1963, 1964. It's easy now, isn't it? Because of the passing of time. But the effect that the Beatles had on America, I mean, people will talk about the British, every time a British band goes over there now, it's like the British invasion. But, you know, when the Beatles played America for the first time and did the Ed Sullivan show, it was a watershed moment.
It was like an atomic bomb went off in the teenage world of America, but also in the adult world, because everyone was glued to the Ed Sullivan show, the British phenomenon, the Fab Four was coming to America. And previous to the British invasion, everything was Motown or beach music. And this was such a shift in gears and such a cool shift in every gear, not just music, but clothes, hairstyle, etc. It really was. You know, when I look at American history from 1900 to the year 2000, I have to say February of 1964 stands out in my mind as much as anything else.
And the other thing I want to talk about is the fact that you took over your brother's position from Countess Fifi, you know, on the OK of Countess Fifi in 1967. And if you're going to divide years of music up, you can say that, you know, that is the height of the Summer of Love. 67 is if you like, what Hunter S. Thompson called the high watermark of the movement, Haight-Ashbury, etc. You know, there's that we've changed from the clean cut use that the Beatles used to be. I wasn't going to say the standard, all the Beach Boys, and we've had Pet Sounds, we've got Sergeant Pepper, we've got Janis, we've got Jimmy, we've got the Monterey Rock Festival, the Jazz Festival, and that period that you wrote between, if you like, 67 to 73, is kind of if you like the late 60s, really.
Because I look at the span of music from when my brother started writing through 1973, before I left journalism to work for a record company. And I have to say that the letter J from Jimi Hendrix to Janis Joplin to Jim Morrison to Brian Jones, et cetera, unfortunately, all those J's ended up dying young. It was a summer of love, but it was a summer of major changes. Here in the United States, some of my friends were being drafted and going to fight in Vietnam. And the Summer of Love produced great music, but also produced a movement that by 1971 had gelled to try to bring the war in Vietnam to an end. And if we look at American culture today and we look at the George Floyd death with a knee on his neck, and we go back to Buffalo Springfield doing For What It's Worth, when they walked out onto the Sunset Strip and saw police beating people, there is a thing that music can do that I wish it was doing today that it did in the 60s, and that was to change politics. But that's another story. I mean, somebody asked me, this has been a week of interviews. I was on Sirius XM radio this week and book talk on Apple Podcasts, et cetera. And one of the interviewers said to me, Michael, tell me, what was Joe Tex like? And I said, well, you know, I did a lot of rhythm and blues interviews at the beginning. My brother said to me, I know you're nervous. Fifi wants you to write three columns. Go to the Howard Theater, which was Washington, D.C.'s kind of Apollo Theater. All black artists, mostly black audience. And do your interviews there. I was known there. I met James Brown backstage at the Howard with my brother when I was 15 years old. So everyone there knew me. And that's my first interviews were rhythm and blues interviews. And I loved that music.
I was going to say, what was it like? What's it like when you meet, you know, the Godfather of Soul himself as well? You know, he was known as he brooked no, you know, no silly business, did he? When he was on stage, he was a taskmaster and a half. What was it like to interview? And again, the thing with music in that period, if I may here, Michael, but music journalism and music artists went from being clean cut who just played the product to having a say, and nobody had more of a say apart from maybe Marvin on the civil rights movement than James Brown.
Right, and first of all, James Brown loved to be interviewed. He was very gracious, but I can tell you that James had his own dressing room. The rest of his band had their dressing room. James Brown's dressing room had more shoes in it than Imelda Marcos ever owned. And James could snap his fingers and a valet would be in the room. James Brown ruled his band, and he had a system of fines set up. If you missed a note, if you missed a beat, if you were late bringing his cape out when he fell down on his knees, you were fined. And I knew James into the 1990s. And I saw him at the House of Blues in Los Angeles in the 90s, and things had changed. That Godfather soul thing had turned more into a Las Vegas kind of act with dancing showgirls on stage, et cetera, because James just didn't have the physical prowess that he had when he was young. When I met him and I was 15, and I have a snapshot of me backstage in his dressing room, James is bare from the waist up, and he had the physique of a boxer because he was a boxer, and he had a big grin, and I noticed around his neck was a chain, and I, you know, being raised Jewish, I knew what a mezuzah was, and I said, James, you're wearing a mezuzah, which is a little Jewish charm that has a prayer scroll in it. And he said, yeah, Michael, my manager, Ben Bart, gave that to me. He's Jewish, and I believe it has special powers. Well, James had more special powers than just about any artist I've ever met. I mean, I've interviewed Curtis Mayfield, The Impressions, Joe Tex, you name the rhythm and blues artist in those days, and I was backstage interviewing them. So the Howard Theater produced a lot of my interviews, but the psychedelic era took me to other places. Everyone I know of my age says they were at Woodstock. Okay? I admit that I wasn't at Woodstock. At the beginning of August 1969, I heard there were two festivals coming up. One was called the Atlantic City Pop Festival. Middle of August, end of August, was something called Woodstock Festival of Arts and Music. I went to my editor at the time, it was no longer Fifi, and I said, will the newspaper pay for me to go to these festivals and cover them? And the editor said, we'll pay for one. And I thought to myself, let's see, Atlantic City, hotel room, that sounds really good. Woodstock, camping out. Jews camped out for 40 years in the desert. I'm not camping out. So I picked the Atlantic City Pop Festival. And I've got to tell you, it was amazing. People don't realize 200,000 people went to the Atlantic City Pop Festival. And it had pretty similar lineup to Woodstock. I ended up having lunch with Johnny Winter in a diner in Atlantic City because his equipment didn't show up. I'm sitting in front of the stage, and somebody passes me a pitcher of sangria. So I'm in a press area. And I had a friend who was a musician who was playing there named Doug Somm,
right.
Mr. Douglas Quintet. He comes out on stage. Before he cracks a note, he sees me in the front with his pitcher of sangria and with his Texas doll. He leans over and says, Mikey, pass me that wine. I pass him the pitcher, not realizing someone had dosed it with LSD. And Doug takes a big hit and passes it off stage to Joe Cocker. So the acid didn't hit Doug while he was on stage, but when Joe Cocker came out, as weird as his movements normally were, I'll tell you, at the Atlantic City Pop Festival, I wish I had a movie camera. It was pretty incredible.
Talking about sort of people, I'm just interested about how you talk about people being maybe a little bit out of it. Jim Morrison, I mean, you interviewed the Doors, you interviewed Jim, you mentioned Jim a bit earlier on. When did you interview him then? What year was that? Because, I mean, he was the Lizard King, he was, considered himself a poet, but he had, the Doors went into, they weren't in a happy time in the late 60s, and obviously Jim wasn't to be around after 71. So when you interviewed Jim, what were you expecting and what did you get?
Well, what I was expecting was not what I got. I interviewed Jim in Philadelphia. They were playing an arena called the Spectrum. And my favorite place to interview a band was not the dressing room because too many hangers on, etc. But it ended up being in the dressing room. And I kid you not, Giles, I expected the Lizard King. And what I got was a guy who looked like he walked out of a college fraternity. And he was very collegiate in style, collegiate in speech, etc. The guy was he had long hair. So it was not... It was far from what I expected. He was gracious and very nice. I've got to say, of the 300 published interviews, and to get 300 interviews, I probably did 400 because some just didn't work out. And I will tell you a story. If you talk about the Summer of Love in the San Francisco scene,
yep.
I had scheduled an interview with the Grateful Dead. I went to New York City, and it was the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers, a midnight show at the Fillmore East.
Ooh, how wonderful.
I may have been the only person. It was unbelievable. Midnight, and the live album came out of that. And so at 6 a.m., the sun's coming up in New York City. I'm walking to the Grateful Dead's hotel. And I know that I must have been the only person at the Fillmore who hadn't dropped acid. I get to the hotel. I get up to Jerry Garcia's room. And it's Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir, John McIntyre, one of their managers, Robert Hunter, the songwriter, a couple of other people. And they had a suite. There was a large coffee table with a gallon jug of Gallo wine on it. And I need an icebreaker. Here I am with, the Grateful Dead. So Jerry Garcia lights up a joint and starts passing it around. I had been kind of an amateur magician and had something with me called flash paper. Are you familiar with what that is?
Refresh my memory.
Flash paper is a paper that bookies, guys who did illegal gambling,
yeah,
would keep the bets on, and it would go up in a ball of fire and leave no ash. And magicians used it to shoot fireballs across stage. So I had this balled up in my hand, and when they passed the joint to me, I dropped the ash in my hand, and a ball of flame shot out of my hand. Well, I had forgotten that the Dead must have been tripping. Garcia picks up a jug of wine and douses my hand, thinking my hand's on fire. And I didn't get an interview out of them because all we did the rest of the morning was talk about flash paper and flash pots. They were blown away by it, and that was the beginning of the Dead starting to use flash pots on stage.
Okay. What about Bowie? Because you interviewed David as well, and that must have been because you had quite you had quite a good relationship with Bowie, I believe.
Well, the Bowie story is pretty amazing because I interviewed him first by phone in 1969. And then in 1971, he hadn't really made it in the United States. My brother was director of publicity for his record company, Mercury, here in the States. My brother flew David to the States for a promotional tour. Back in those days, for a British group to play, to perform in America, an American group had to perform in Great Britain.
Right.
That wasn't happening, so Bowie couldn't perform. So he came here to meet disc jockeys and writers. He had said to my brother on the phone, I want to spend my first day with the typical American family. So David flew into Dulles Airport in Virginia. My brother flew in from Chicago. My parents and myself went to Dulles Airport and picked David and my brother up, went back to Silver Spring, Maryland, had drinks with David at my parents' house, went to a steakhouse called Emerson's for dinner, and then back to my house in Tacoma Park, where one of the bands I'd been managing at the time was in the living room, and they were blown away by this British guy and kind of stymied by his style.
I was going to say, what was it, I mean, what was the style like? And when you walked into a, you know, an average American steakhouse with David Bowie in 1971, didn't the order stop in midair kind of thing?
Everyone stared, and we were put in a booth that had curtains, and the hostess closed the curtains on the booth.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so it was an unbelievable first day for Bowie, first day and night. Bowie ended up in Chicago in my brother's office, and my brother handed David several 45 RPM records released on Mercury, some of his label mates, and said, David, you've got to listen to this record by the legendary Stardust Cowboy. And David did. And David was blown away. And David took the name Stardust as part of Ziggy Stardust. And in fact, I've read interviews with David later that he had to name his 10 heroes, and the legendary Stardust Cowboy was one of them. If you get a chance on your show, try to find the record Paralyzed by the legendary Stardust Cowboy.
I'm writing it down.
Bowie ended up covering a song called I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship that the legendary Stardust Cowboy made. There is a documentary being made now on the legendary Stardust Cowboy by filmmaker Jeff Fierzig, who did a great music documentary called The Devil and Daniel Johnson. I'm in the documentary, but I will be animated. It's a fully animated documentary. I will be an animated character named Michael Oberman talking about David Bowie's first day in the United States.
That's going to be something trippy, isn't it, to watch yourself as an animated character?
And you know what? Jeff will not tell me what I'm going to look like. They're doing it. The pandemic set the production back a little, but they're doing the animation is going to take 1 year, and they're about 3 months into it. Coincidentally, when I was signed to my book contract by Backbeat Books, I had gotten a message from a woman in Great Britain named Rachel Leggett, who runs one of the David Bowie fan clubs. And Rachel messaged me that, oh, did you know, Michael, that Salon Pictures in Great Britain, the company that did Churchill and My Weekend with Marilyn, is doing a film called Stardust about David Bowie's trip to the United States and your family? And I said, no. So I wrote to Salon Pictures and got in touch with Paul Dan Carter, one of the producers of the movie, one of the owners of Salon. And he said, oh, Michael, so good to talk to you. You know, I said, well, I can give you a lot of background information because you don't know about my brother. And unfortunately, you can't talk to my brother now because he currently is in the final stages of dementia. So Paul says, I'm going to have Gabriel Range, the director, get in touch with you. Months went by. I'm beginning to read press releases about the making of this movie and see that a podcaster and comedian named Mark Maron, who's in his mid-50s, has been cast to play my brother, who was 27 at the time. So I thought, something's fishy here. Well, I get a call finally in August from Gabriel Range. Michael, so good to talk to you finally. I said, oh, Gabriel, nice to meet you. How can I help you with some background? Oh, we finished shooting the film last week in Hamilton, Canada. I said, oh, can you tell me the gist of the film? Well, it's a buddy picture about that trip to America where your brother and David drove across country in your brother's beat-up old station wagon. And I said, well, my brother never drove across country with David. He didn't have a beat-up old station wagon. So the interesting thing is the film opens this week at the Raindance Film Festival in London. And on November 6th, it can be watched on the Raindance site for free. It's going to be streamed. So I'm very, very curious. In the two-minute trailer that I saw of the movie, Mark Maron playing my brother drops the F-bomb twice.
Right.
And my brother never cursed in his entire life. Maron comes off as a coarse New York publicity guy, and that was so far from my brother. So I'm a little chagrined at the movie, and a lot of Bowie fans are chagrined. And Duncan Jones, David's son, didn't want anything to do with the film and would not allow the licensing of David's music for the film. So Johnny Flynn wrote a couple of songs, one of which he does in the movie, but there's no Bowie music in the movie at all.
Let's get back to because we're going to run out of time, as you can probably gather. I could talk to you most of the rest of the day, but you moved away from the music business, and you moved away from music journalism, going to the business itself, and now is it photography is your passion?
Yeah. When I turned 50. I said, you know, because I managed a number of artists after I stopped writing, I said, I've been helping other people with their art. I'm going to concentrate on my art. And I left the wildlife, the music business, for wildlife photography. So most of my work is nature and wildlife, though I've done several album covers. It is the tranquility that I longed for. You know what the music business is like. This is your life. And at one point when I was working for Jack Boyle on Celador concerts, my day started at 10 a.m. in the office, and it ended at 2 a.m. closing out a concert, a major concert. It was hectic. It was, when I say drugs were rampant in those days, you couldn't go into a record company office or into a dressing room without someone pulling out a mirror and laying out lines of cocaine. I mean, and John Denver taking home Country Roads. I was at a party, and he took out a mirror and laid out concentric lines of cocaine. This is clean cut, Rocky Mountain of Water, John Denver doing coke. Well, this was a life that I didn't want to continue because I never thought if you knew me in 1967 when I was 19 years old and started writing about music and said, Michael, what do you think you'd be doing in the year 2020? I would have said, pushing up daisies or on a rocket ship to Venus. Neither of those happened, thank God, but my love of nature won out. But I'm also happy because in 2009, just as my brother was starting to slip into dementia and I didn't know it, he was in Los Angeles and I was in Maryland, we decided to write a book together. We got a major agent and we started to write. And he would email me a chapter and I would email him a chapter. And his writing became really bad. I knew something was wrong. It turned out to be dementia. So the project was put on hold. I have had the book, has been in me since 1967 when I started writing. At that time, I never thought it would end up being a book. But when I realized how many artists I had interviewed, and my brother had interviewed 150, I interviewed 300, it really should be a textbook for any university that teaches anything about rock and roll, because these are snippets, these are snapshots of acts, often at the beginning of their career. And it was like I'd been pregnant for half a century, and I finally gave birth. I had been goaded and prodded by friends to write the book without a publisher, just to self-publish. I said, I'm not going to do that. How am I going to market it? How am I going to end up on Talk Radio Europe? How am I going to end up on Sirius Radio? I can't do that myself. But I did something very different. I was taking a walk by a lake with my camera, and I ran into a friend. And right. He said to me, Michael, have you written your book yet? I said, you know, I've got several chapters done, but I'm not going to deal with agents any longer. He said, well, Backbeat Books is the main company that puts out music-related memoirs. Why don't you get in touch with them? I said, they're not going to accept an unsolicited manuscript. I went home that night and I said, damn, I'm just going to send three chapters and take a shot. And I sent three chapters to Backbeat Books, and 2 days later I got a call. Michael, we love it.
And the rest of the...
sign you, and they signed me.
The rest, as they said, is history. Do you think you were quite lucky, though, because you were writing these days, you can't interview a rock star without having a PR person, you get 5 minutes. I mean, I'm just looking at pictures now of you and your brother and David Bowie sitting on at your parents' house on a green sofa. It's a wonderful picture. And times like that, and no rock star now would be allowed to do that, would they?
No, you know, and if you'll notice, music journalism, you don't see it in major newspapers today. The Washington Post, which is the main paper here in Washington, the Star that I wrote for, was in business for 132 years, but because they were evening paper, they went out of business because people would come home from work and put on the evening news. They didn't want to read an evening paper. So the Washington Post, once every 3 months, maybe there's a music-related story. You just don't see it. It's much tougher to interview an act. I just got a copy of my book, The Bonnie Raitt, because she's in it. And also, I write a eulogy for a mutual friend of ours at the end of the book, Ed Kalika, who worked for Warner Brothers Records. And I knew Bonnie would want to read that. So I wanted to get a copy to Bruce Springsteen, because my brother is the guy who, when he was at Columbia Records, Columbia was going to drop Bruce after his first album bombed.
Yeah.
My brother said, you can't do that.
Indeed. Michael, I really hate my to brother. Do this to you, but I'm going to run out of time because we've only got 4 minutes left before my show finishes. The book is called Maybe
Oh,
We...
Oh, dear.
I know, but to find out more, go and buy the book, Fast Forward, Play and Rewind. You have a website for your photography, don't you? And where can we find you on the internet?
Yes, michaelobermanphotography.com.
Michael, I'm going to have to cut you short. I could have spoken to you for the rest of the evening, but Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Dal, thank you so much.